Okay, so let's begin the lecture today. And the topic of the lecture today is performance evaluation. I'm very excited about this topic because I think it's extremely important for compensation and benefits in particular, as well as for basically any other topic that has to do with people, that has to do with personnel, that has to do with strategic behavior of individuals in organizations. So it's very, very relevant. Now, because of the importance of this topic, we will certainly spend a lecture today on performance evaluation, and we may have to run over to the next lecture. Now, the next lecture next week, is supposed to be a lecture about discrimination, and the slides are there, and the lecture is ready. We can still do a lecture on discrimination, but if we have to, we will take time from the next lecture for performance evaluation, because discrimination is more important than, sorry, the other way around, because performance evaluation is more important than discrimination. And you will have fewer topics to study for the exam, so it's Pareto improvement. Now, so let us look at this piece of text and read it in its entirety, and then read only the odd lines, and what we will see is two completely different pictures. So this is a piece of text, well, of course, it's a sort of quasi wordplay, but very often you read evaluation reports. I read a lot of evaluation reports, and I do a lot of evaluation reports myself. And basically 99.9% of evaluation reports are very positively written, but there are some clues from which the sometimes very different picture emerges. So John Doe, an assistant programmer, can always be found hard at work in his cubicle. Joe works independently without wasting company time talking to colleagues. Joe never thinks twice about... So what a great employee Joe is, but then... if you read only the odd-numbered lines, Joe Smith, my assistant programmer, can always be found wasting company time talking to colleagues. Joe never finishes given assignments on time. He often takes extended coffee breaks. He's an individual who has absolutely no knowledge in his field. I firmly believe that... So this is an, you know, it's a clip from the compensation textbook, and I think it exposes the dangers of performance evaluation. What it does not expose is the importance of performance evaluation, right? So it's very easy to dismiss the whole exercise of performance evaluation as basically a costly, time-consuming procedure which is riddled by all sorts of strategic considerations. And because it's riddled with all sorts of strategic considerations, the final outcome of this procedure is basically noise. Everybody is super nice. Now, this can be the case. This can be the case. However, there is lots of performance evaluation. You have done performance evaluation for this course, and your performance is constantly evaluated. So there are various reasons why performance is evaluated and reasons why performance needs to be evaluated despite the dangers and problems with performance evaluation, as sometimes we can see in practice as well in this entertaining clip. So here are a few reasons why performance needs to be evaluated. The main reason is if you want to practice incentives, incentives are based on a certain X. Where does this X come from? It needs to be measured. Right. So in the theory, in the lectures that we spent talking about the theory behind incentives, we've gone through a few incentive pay models with and without performance targets for risk neutral as well as for risk averse agents. So we've seen a lot of incentive pay models. What was the assumption behind this endeavor so far is that you can measure performance costlessly. There is some device that measures performance without you having to spend any effort on measuring performance, but it's not the case. And today we're going to extend our theoretical discussion into the incentives, into the theory of incentives, and we will incorporate the difficulty and costs of measuring performance. So, but you need to measure performance in order to practice performance-related incentives. Now, on a less practical and more strategic note, performance needs to be measured The very exercise of performance measurement makes firm values and the key performance indicators that firm believes to be important, it makes them more salient, right? So if I can be told by the dean of studies that what is important for students is the clarity of exposition, is the exam relevance, the practice relevance, and scholastic quality of lectures. But that's what I can be told, right? Whether it's the case or not. But then when I get a student evaluation form, I see the positions against which my performance on the course is evaluated, and the elements of my performance, of my teaching performance, that I see in the student evaluation form are becoming very salient, and I get the idea that yes, it is important, and next time I should try and address these particular aspects of performance. So communicate firm values in a salient way. To recognize and promote talent in organizations, right? So a lot of promotions, salary increase, and other HR practices, both positive and negative, are based on performance evaluation results. So people who get a relatively high evaluations get promoted faster, get more money. People who get relatively low evaluations may get even demoted or maybe delayed promotion or may even be fired. So there was this rank and yank practice. Maybe you've heard about it. A General Electric is the pioneer in this practice. It's been abandoned now. So basically, if your performance evaluation is within the bottom 5% or whatever, the bottom X percent, you're thrown out of the company. That's pretty tough, huh? Right? They don't do it right now, but it used to be the case. So performance evaluation also is needed to understand the training needs and directions for personal developments that people need to take. So if I see that my research performance is highly ranked, but my teaching performance is lowly ranked, what signal do I get? The signal I get really is to concentrate on my research performance and forget teaching, right? But that's a sort of K-level reasoning. But, you know, on a more naive note, in terms of the textbook that these guys have written, the lesson I should learn is that I should really intensify on the teaching front of my activities. But if you communicate it well enough, and if you make career and cash prospects more dependent on your teaching performance evaluation, and of course people will listen and become super teachers. You want to signal job matches and weed them out. Feedback, performance is feedback, right? And people like feedback. When I get the email from Stabstelle Qualitätsmanagement from the University of Konstanz, this is the department in the organization that runs this evaluation procedure, and they send me these PDF files with performance results, I abandon everything and I click the link, and I'm so impatient to look at my performance. I don't really care about my performance. Don't really care. Of course I care. The fact that my teaching performance evaluation, especially for the case of undergraduate students, they often suck, doesn't mean that I don't care. People like to receive feedback. They are interested in receiving feedback. They want to compare their performance with the average. They want to see how well they're doing relative to the rest. They want to see whether they are conforming to social norms or not. So performance gives them this feedback, and people need it, people like it, people are interested. And if you want to induce some useful turnover within your organization, if you want to weed out bad job worker matches, basically to make it a little bit less politically correct, if you want to weed out the really useless people like Joe Smith, an assistant programmer from that evaluation report, you want to give them really the bad performance evaluation results, then they will receive this as feedback, and maybe they will resign voluntarily rather than you having to fire them through formal procedure, which is very expensive and long in Europe. So And speaking of feedback, performance is feedback, and feedback is good for people performance within an organization. Now, so there are various reasons why we need to evaluate performance. In this lecture, we're not going to be talking about each and every reason in great detail. I think it suffices just to name them. What we will be talking in this particular lecture, and maybe next week if we need additional time, the focus is scientific principles of performance evaluation. So performance evaluation is not art, right? It's not something that people should do because they get some brain waves from space. It's not because they want to experience their existential feelings in the design of performance evaluation. No, it's the the best way to think about performance evaluation is an engineering practice which has some science behind it, and it is the science behind performance evaluation and scientific principles behind performance evaluation we're going to focus on today. And also, we will talk about the application of scientific principles of performance evaluation in practice. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at practical examples of performance evaluation procedures, performance evaluation forms, performance evaluation routines, and we will be looking into how closely the practice of performance evaluation resembles the scientific principles of performance evaluation and the, well, it turns out that there is quite a close relationship between performance evaluation, how it's done in practice, and scientific principles of performance evaluation. So, speaking of principles of performance evaluation, there is a wonderful textbook by Milgram and Roberts, Paul Milgram and John Roberts. They are very big figures in organizational economics, both professors at Stanford University, and they wrote this textbook called Economics, Organization and Management. It's an old textbook. I think it's 1990 something. I forgot the year. It's more than 20 years old. And as far as I know, it hasn't been reissued since, which is a great pity because there are lots of Mickey Mouse books that have seen their 29th edition, right, and have generated lots of cash for their authors. But this book is not a Mickey Mouse book. It's a great textbook. I use it, well, maybe not for every lecture, but it's an excellent reference to the core principles of organizational economics. And here's a quotation from this book, which I will spare you reading, but basically the point of this quotation is that you can only pay incentives based on something that you can measure, right? Or based on something that you can observe. That's why you need performance evaluation. Now, you need to have a good measure of performance in order to practice incentives. Now, what is a good measure of performance? What is a good measure of agents' performance? A good measure of agents' performance is a measure which corresponds to four of these principles. So hence the scientific principles of performance measure. They determine what is a good measure of performance and what is a bad measure of performance. So the first is it has to be as precise as economically reasonable. And the label for it is the monitoring intensity principle. So you have to use as precise performance measures as possible. No, you have to use as precise measures of performance as economically reasonable, because don't forget, so what is the business of performance of performance measurement? You can measure things very precisely. You can never measure things with absolutely zero noise. You can't even measure things in physics with absolutely zero noise, let alone social sciences like economics. So there will always be noise, but you can, but with a lot of additional effort, you can reduce the noise, and so you can get very precise measures of performance. But then think about how much it's going to cost you. Every reduction in the noisiness of your performance measure comes at an additional cost, which can grow up quite steeply. So you should not use the most precise measure of performance available. You should use the as precise measure of performance as economically reasonable. So you should always compare the gains from more accurate measure of performance and the costs, additional costs of more accurate measure of performance, and find the optimal degree of accuracy that maximizes the difference between the gains and the costs. Now, what are the gains of precise performance measurement? The gains of precise performance measurement can be established from a rather basic model of incentive pay. You may recall that the lower the noisiness, the lower the variance of performance measure, the more the stronger incentives you can offer to a risk-averse agent. The stronger incentives you offer to risk-averse agent, the harder he or she will work. So the gains from a precise performance measurement are basically higher effort of the incentivized agents. The costs are the costs. We will look at this in greater detail today and later today when we have a tutorial on performance measurement. Now, the second principle of performance measurement is the so-called informativeness principle. The informativeness principle of performance measurement says quite simply that you should use all the information that's available to you to evaluate performance, right? So when we at the university want to hire someone, we recently hired a junior professor for personnel economics. We want to look into the candidate's research, we want to look into the candidate's teaching activities, we want to look into the candidate's record of obtaining research grants, we want to look into the candidate's references from more established figures in the profession. So we want to use all sources of information that are available to evaluate the performance of a certain individual. And that's according to the informativeness principle. And if there is information available which costs additional money, then we are in the business of the monitoring intensity principle. We should compare whether it's worth it. But the measures that are available, you should use them all. Yeah. So now, the third scientific principle of performance evaluation is so-called equal compensation principle. And it's a very important principle. You can't overestimate its importance. These guys are sort of next to obvious, right? It's quite straightforward. Now, this equal compensation principle says that a performance measure that you use for the purposes of performance evaluation and performance-related pay should reflect and equally reward all the activities that are important for the principal, right? We will look into this equal compensation principle in greater detail today, but very briefly, what it says is that you should devise performance evaluation and incentive schemes in such a way that the marginal benefit from effort spent on all the relevant measures, all the relevant dimensions of performance by the agent should be the same. If this equal, so every direction of effort should receive equal compensation. If the equal compensation principle breaks down, if you are rewarded more, relatively more for one aspect of performance than for the other, then what's going to happen is that the agent who wants to maximize his net utility will fully focus on only one aspect of performance and neglect the other aspects of performance, and the agent will of course maximize his benefits, but the benefits for the principal will be compromised by this selective effort choice. You see in hospitals doctors tending to operate on relatively easy cases and neglect the relatively hard cases. You know, you tend to observe the same behavior in social services, right? It's much nicer if you are if you work in the Deutsche Agentur für Arbeit, if you are a consultant there helping people get back into employment, it's much nicer to talk to someone who has lost, to someone who is qualified and prime age and education, who has lost his job, because men are, you know, they have better labor market prospects, unfortunately, well, for the equality purposes. It's much nicer to speak to someone who is going to find a job next week, and then you will you will put a fat tick in your performance evaluation form saying, look, I've sent this person into job, than to speak to someone who is long-term unemployed, who is uneducated, who is chronically sick, who is lazy, who doesn't have a clue, right? So because this person is never going to find a job and you're never going to have your performance evaluated as highly as in the case of this prime labor market candidate. So the equal compensation principle in particular, what it means is that very often organizations say, okay, we're not going to have any incentives. Because whatever incentive scheme we can practically implement is going to be in violation of the equal compensation principle, because people will simply neglect some important aspects of performance which are hard to evaluate, and so we will abandon incentives altogether. It's a very, very important thing. Now, and finally, there is the so-called alignment principle, which says that the performance measure that you use to evaluate performance and administer incentive pay should be affected by the agent's effort to the same extent and in the same direction as the outcome that is desired by the principal. Now, this alignment principle, it extends the business of incentives to the case, a very relevant case empirically, when you have an outcome that is really important for the firm, for the organization, and you don't observe this outcome, or it's very impractical or expensive to observe this outcome. Look at the monitoring intensity principle. But what you do instead is you observe some proxies of this outcome. Like a typical example, firms want to increase their long-term value. What is the long-term value of the firm? Talk to some accounting professor. I have no idea what the long-term value of the firm is, right? So there are various measures that seem to be statistically correlated with firms' long-term profitability and firms' likelihood of staying in business, return on investment, etc. The problem is that all these long-term outcomes, value measures of the firm, they are observed, yes, in the long term. And you need to reward performance in the short term, right? Because we live not so long. And so you have to use a proxy for the outcome that is desired by the principal. And the alignment principle requires that this proxy has to be affected by the agent's effort in the same way as the outcome. Because if it's not affected by the agent's effort in the same outcome, you're going to have misalignment. You're going to have agent working towards maximizing the proxy based on which his salary is calculated, without necessarily affecting the value to the principal to the same extent. So, and again, when this principle breaks down, many firms prefer not to have incentives at all rather than have perverse incentives that suffer from the lack of alignment problem. So let's look at the relatively easy monitoring intensity principle. So what it says is that there are costs and benefits of a more precise performance measure. So let's talk about the benefits of more precise performance measure. Here is the here's the formula for the optimal strengths of incentives in the case of a linear incentive scheme. Not all incentive schemes are linear, but you know the linear incentive scheme gives you tractable maths. That's why it's so popular. So this is the optimal strength of incentives, which is the general case. You either use the output or some proxy for the output. You have costs of effort, risk aversion, and the noisiness with which with which performance is measured. And what you can see immediately is that lower sigma squared, more precisely measured performance, means higher strength of incentives. Higher strength of incentives means higher effort. Higher effort means more cash for the principal, right? So it makes sense to use the best, that is most precise available measure of performance on which you want to calculate incentives. However, performance measurement comes at a cost, and so far we have ignored these costs, but they exist, right? If you want to measure my performance, my performance is measured as it is, and the measures for my performance are, you know, these 5-minute questionnaires that students fill in during one of the lectures, right? So what are the costs of this performance measurement? They are not zero, but they're not very high. What is the quality of these performance measures? Well, it's not total noise, right? But it's also not very accurate because you can distort my performance measure by the presence of a few outliers who absolutely hate me and will put fives in every position in the evaluation form. This performance measure can also be distorted by the fact that there's only a subset of relatively committed and dedicated, thank you very much, people who come to my lectures, and the people who are also benefiting from my lectures, hi those who watch me online, they will not evaluate my performance. So there are all sorts of problems with this performance measure. Can you make it more precisely? Sure. You can do phone interviews with students, structured or semi-structured. You can hire sociologists to really try to quantify the various nuances of my performance. You will spend thousands of hours, and the costs of you will get super precise measure of performance, but the cost of measuring of it will be very high. So let us model this aspect by allowing for the term M of sigma squared. So M of sigma squared is the costs of measurement. And if you want to have noisier measure of performance, you can have it cheaper. That's why the first derivative of the measurement costs is negative. And it's also a concave. If you want to, so every additional increase in the noisiness of the measure saves you cost at a decreasing rate. Now, to turn this argument around, every additional reduction in the noisiness of the measure, every additional increase in the precision of the measure costs you increasingly more. So if you go from right to left, right, from high sigma squared to low sigma squared, then every additional reduction in sigma squared is going to cost you progressively more. So this is the costs of measurement, costs of performance measurement. Let us add these costs of performance measurement into the principal's profit function. So this is the principal's profit function as we know it. And we add the cost of performance measurement. We used to maximize this principal's profit function only with respect to beta, and that's how we derived the optimal strength of incentives. But what we have ignored so far is that this optimal incentives business costs money, and now we want to globally optimize the principal's profit by also choosing the optimal degree of precision of performance. So we maximize this profit not only with respect to beta, but also with respect to sigma squared. And the first order condition with respect to sigma squared is here, and what it does is it relates the precision of performance and the strength of incentives together. So don't forget that M prime is negative, so minus negative means something positive. This guy is positive, this guy is negative, so they equate zero. What it means in particular is, if you want to have stronger incentives, if you want to have higher beta means larger term here, you need to have smaller sigma squared to compensate. Vice versa, if you find performance measure to be increasingly prohibitively expensive, then you have to settle for weaker incentives, because otherwise you're not doing the optimal thing. If you are practicing super high incentives based on lousy measure of performance, people will be exposed to too much risk, and they will require too high fixed wage as a compensation for this risk, and this of course will impact your profit in an obvious way. So all this shows is that there's a trade-off between how strong incentives you want to have and how precisely you want to measure the performance. It turns out, and we will look into this in greater detail later today during the tutorial time, it turns out that you can derive the optimal strength of incentives and the optimal precision with which performance is measured by solving these two equations as a system simultaneously. And so the solution of these two equations simultaneously will give you the optimal strength of incentives and the precision with which performance is measured. And the two are obviously related, right? The stronger incentives you want to have, the more precisely the lower sigma squared you should have. Now, the relationship between these two is not very important because they're both endogenous, right? What is more interesting is the effect of some exogenous factors on the optimum, the parameters of the incentive pay contract. For instance, suppose you have an increase in productivity. You have two workers, one is very productive, the other one is not so very productive. So how should you measure the performance of a relatively less productive person, and what sort of incentives should you offer to the less productive person as opposed to the more productive person? It turns out that if the marginal productivity of effort increases, then you need both higher strength of incentives and lower sigma squared. So people, people whose productivity is higher, people at the top of the organizational hierarchy, they receive stronger incentives and more effort is spent on measuring their performance. If people are not so productive, the people are at the bottom of the organizational hierarchy, nobody really cares about measuring their performance with any degree of precision, and as a result their sigma squared, their optimal sigma squared is large and their optimal strength of incentives is low. And that makes a lot of sense if you look at real organizations. So this is your monitoring intensity principle. Is everything more or less clear? Does that make sense? We will also look at the we will also have some exercises during the tutorial session today. Now let's look at the next principle, the informativeness principle. And what it says, just to remind you, is you should use all information that's freely available to you in order to evaluate people's performance and reward people's performance in the form of incentive pay. So suppose you're stuck in an equilibrium in which a further measurement of your performance is prohibitively expensive, so you're stuck with low incentives and noisy performance measure. How can you improve situation? You can improve situation by using additional measures that are informative of the agent's effort in one way or another, or the other. So there are two ways in which an additional measure may be informative of the agent's effort. And hence these two examples. In the first example, we have the existing measure of performance Z, which is a function of effort plus an additive noise term. Suppose there's another indicator of effort, right? I can infer your effort not only from, you know, the amount of sales that you generate on your account, but also I can infer your effort from, say, customer service reports that I receive from you, right? So Z is your sales and I is your customer service, and they are all related to your effort. Both these measures are imperfect because there is an additive noise term to both of these measures. So the Z is measured with a noise term eta, and I is measured with a noise term epsilon. And these noise terms are not correlated with each other. If they are, to the extent to which they are correlated with each other, it's not the end of the world. But we will then move to the second example. So let's stick with the first example, when you have two independent measures of performance. So if you have two independent measures of performance, you can Pareto improve, you can do better, you can increase your profit by respecifying the incentive pay contract from a linear function of only one variable to the linear function of two variables, Z and I. So the additional measure of performance should enter with a coefficient beta I, which is not necessarily zero. Now, if you want to do it as a practice question and calculate the optimal strength of incentives with respect to Z and with respect to I, then these are the expressions that you're going to have, right? So what you see is that the strength of incentives, the coefficient on Z, is not equal to the original beta. So the availability of additional information, the availability of additional information changes the strength of incentives that you optimally choose for the existing measure of performance. And another thing that you see from here is that this guy is not necessarily zero. It can be zero, in which case the measure of the additional measure of information is additional measure I is useless, but it's not always zero. Now let us look at the optimal use of additional information concealed in the variable I. So if this additional information measure is useful, you're going to use it. You're going to have optimal strength of incentives with respect to Z and with respect to I. But if this additional measure of information is useless, what does it mean, useless? It means that it's very, very noisy, right? It's very noisy. So noisy that it's not informative of the agent's effort. If it's very noisy, then, well, if you take a limit of these expressions with respect to the variance of this additional noise measure I, take a limit when it approaches infinity, you will see that when this approaches infinity, beta with respect to Z approaches the originally practiced beta, and the strength of incentives with respect to this useless measure approaches zero. You can immediately see it here, right? So so you use this additional performance measure only to the extent to which it's useful. But if it's useful, if its noise is not infinite, you will use it to the extent proportional to how informative it is. I think it sort of makes intuitive sense. The maths may require some attention, but the intuitive idea is very clear, I think, right? Any questions so far? No. Right, let's move to the second example. So I was talking about useful and useless measure, right? And so far I said, well, the measure I is useful if it's somehow related to the agent's effort, right? But it does not exhaust it does not mean that the measure of additional measure of performance is useful only to the extent to which it's informative of effort. It may also be useful to the extent to which it's informative of the noise to effort. And here comes the example two. So here's your linear incentive pay contract. You are basing incentive pay on only one performance measure Z, let's say sales, so far so standard. And then suppose there's an additional measure I, which is not related to agent's effort at all, right? So it's you know that it's not related to agent's effort at all because you take this additional measure I from, let's say, a completely different agents from a completely different department in a completely different geographical area, right? So you know by default that it has nothing to do with the effort of this particular agent. Question is, should you or should you not incorporate it into a performance measurement exercise and into the design of incentive scheme? It turns out that whether you use this additional measure I or not depends on what it tells you about the noise to the agent's existing performance measure. So let us be agnostic and write down the agent's incentive pay contract as the linear function of Z, the existing performance measure, as well as a linear function B times gamma of this seemingly useless measure of performance. It's seemingly useless because it's not related to the agent's effort. But if it's really useless, then we're going to have a coefficient gamma equals zero, so we're not going to use it, right? But to the extent to which gamma is not zero, it means that it's useful. And let's see what determines the extent to which an additional performance measure I is useful. So after doing some algebra, here is the expected profit of the principal. And what you see is that the expected profit of the principal, as before, is as before, is reduced by the variance of the income of the agent. Why is it reduced by the variance of the income to the agent? Because this is the agent's participation constraint. This is how much money you should pay to the agent to keep the agent on the participation constraint. And it depends on the reservation wage, which you cannot do anything with, but it also depends on the extent to which, on the noisiness of the performance measure that you use. Now, the optimal incentive scheme will minimize the noisiness of the performance measure, or the noisiness of the performance outcome that the principal is using to evaluate the agent's performance. Why? Because the noisier it is, the higher fixed wage you're going to have to pay to the agent. So we choose beta to minimize the difference between output and variance, but we can also choose gamma in order to further minimize the variance given the beta. So if we take the first order condition with of the principal's expected profit with respect to the coefficient gamma of in this incentive scheme, we will see that you know the prize in the game is to minimize this variance. You want to choose the gamma to minimize this variance. Now, what is the variance of a linear combination of eta and I? So if eta and I are independent, if eta and I are caused by completely different random processes, totally unrelated random processes, then you're not gaining anything by using this additional measure of performance. But if eta and I are correlated, if there is this covariance term in the variance, right, then you can choose gamma so as to minimize this variance. So here's the variance of the noise to performance. I think it's clear why it's the case. The variance of two random variables is equal to the sum of variances plus twice the covariance. That's what you see there. If this covariance is not zero, you can further improve your profits. You can further strengthen the incentives to the agent by choosing the coefficient gamma on this seemingly irrelevant and useless measure of the agent's performance so as to minimize the variance of the performance measure that the principal is using to reward the agent with. So as long as eta and I are there's some correlation between them, I is useful. One example of this performance measure used in practice is the so-called relative performance evaluation. Have you heard of relative performance evaluation? No? Yes? To give you an example. So let's go back to year 2008, end of 2008. The Great Recession is in its near full swing. Everybody's reeling. Everybody is, you know, the Wall Street bankers are divorcing and shooting themselves in the temple. There is recession. Everybody is depressed. So here is a car dealership in Frankfurt. Here's a car dealership in Frankfurt, which sold 60% fewer cars than the target. 60% fewer cars. And the question is, should the employees in this car dealership be given their bonus or not? And you'd say, you know, based on absolute performance evaluation scheme, you'd say, of course not, come on. They are so much below the target. What bonus are you talking about? But then notice that other dealerships within the same network their sales fell 60% below the target. So in absolute terms, the Frankfurt guys did very badly. But relative to the rest of the firm, they did well. Question is, should you give them a bonus or not? While the answer to this question is still not an unqualified yes, I think the balance of the argument moves from an absolute no to maybe. Now, what does this maybe depend on? This maybe depends on the relationship between the random factors affecting the performance of the Frankfurt branch and the random factors affecting the performance of the rest of the organization. Now, what are the random factors affecting the performance of the organization in general and the Frankfurt branch in particular? Macroeconomy. Macroeconomy is the obvious factor affecting the performance beyond the effort that agents can put into their work. If the economy is doing badly, if there's recession, right? People don't buy cars. You know, it doesn't matter how hard you work, people will not buy cars. This is a major factor, which is going to be part of the, which is going to be part of the noise eta of the of your main performance measure, as well as part of the I, part of the measure I, which has nothing to do with the agent's effort, but which is still influenced by the same random factors as the ones sitting in this performance measure, right? And if you want to have a less noisy performance measure, you want to use the information in I in order to tease out some of the random factors that are sitting in eta. If you want to make an adjustment for the factors beyond the agent's control, such as macroeconomy, you should look at the, you should find another measure of performance which is influenced by macroeconomy and is not influenced by the agent's effort, and do the cancellation. So a typical relative performance evaluation scheme would pay beta for every, you know, for every euro of your own sales, and it would pay minus gamma for every euro of the sales generated by other departments. And if you do the simplification, you would have, so you'd pay beta your own x minus gamma times the x of others, or you could also do something like this. You could have you could rewrite this incentive scheme in this way. So here is your here is the piece rate for your own output, and here is the piece rate for every euro of output which is above the so-called benchmark group, which is above the output of others. This is what many firms are doing, by the way. And why do they do so? What is the science behind this relative performance evaluation principle? The science behind this relative performance evaluation principle is that is because it's the optimal thing to do. If there is a correlation between your output and the output of others, which happens because of the common error terms in X and X0, in X and X others, you should use this correlation because accounting for this correlation can reduce the noise in performance. Relative performance evaluation is very, very frequently practiced, more frequently than absolute performance evaluation. There are, of course, issues there, which we can discuss if we have time. But just to make sure, is the argument clear? If you have questions, please feel free to ask, okay? Everything clear? Right. Now let's move to the equal compensation principle. The equal compensation principle broadens the scope of our inquiry and allows us to incorporate various dimensions of performance. So far we looked at unidimensional effort. So the monitoring intensity principle, there was only one E. The effort was not a vector of effort spent on different dimensions. The effort was just a scalar, right? E. We looked at informativeness principle. We say, but you're using different measures of performance. Yes, you are using different measures of performance, but all these measures of performance are influenced by the same scalar effort, like in example one. Here, we're looking at a much more complicated case in which effort is multidimensional. So you spend your effort generating sales, you spend your effort, you could spend your effort in the direction of serving customers, You can spend some of your effort in the direction of developing new business. You can spend some of your effort in the direction of decorating your office. So all these directions of effort generate their different performance outcomes, and all these performance outcomes affect the value from your activities to the principal. So to think about this case, which is very relevant empirically, let us recall the equal compensation principle. So what it says? It says, well, effort is multidimensional, and the equal compensation principle requires that that all effort dimensions, generating sales, generating customers, looking after customer service, decorating your office if it's important for the value of the principal, all the effort dimensions should receive equal reward per unit of effort. If not, then the agent will focus on the most highly rewarded dimensions of effort that generate the relatively high income and will ignore the rest. Typical example, quantity versus quality. It's easy to measure quantity. It's easy to calculate how much you've sold at the end of the accounting year. Quality is not so easy to measure. It's possible. You can run all sorts of questionnaires. You can interview customers, etc. And that's done all the time. I mean, I receive a lot of questionnaires asking me to rate my experience of buying on a certain website and talking to certain customer service officers. It happens all the time. I delete these things most of the time. I think most of people do it most of the time, which means that measuring customer service is relatively difficult, relatively less precise. What happens is, if you use the monitoring intensity principle, then you would have stronger incentives for sales and weaker incentives for customer service, right? But if you do that, you will be in breach of the equal compensation principle, and people will concentrate only on sales and they will forget customer service. So you will have lots of sales, but a lot of grumpy customers which will not renew their custom in the years to come, and that's of course not good for the firm. Now, this is how it looks mathematically. It's very, very messy, so we're not really going very deeply into the matter because it's very messy, but I think it's enough to illustrate the basic idea. So here's a situation in which there are two dimensions of effort, E1 and E2. Think about it as sales and customer service. So they are equally important. Are they equally important? I'm not sure whether they're equally important for the principal, but they are important. They're both important for the principal to some extent. Okay. Now, suppose the principal wants to reward these activities, and in the general case, the principal wants to reward these activities differently. Because the principal thinks, okay, sales you can measure precisely, so you can incentivize the agent more strongly based on sales. Customer service you can't measure very precisely, so beta 2 should be different from beta 1. Okay. But if you go ahead with this argument and take the first order condition with respect to the different dimensions of effort from the agent's certainty equivalent, from the agent's net payoff maximization function, you will see that the first order condition with respect to E1 and E2 dictates that these rewards, that the per unit rewards on activity 1 and activity 2 should be equal, and they should be equal to the marginal cost of effort. If this first order condition breaks down, you have a corner solution. Very easy. If this condition breaks down, you have a corner solution in which either E1 is equal to zero and people spend all their time doing E2, or the other way around, depends on the precise configuration of beta 1 and beta 2, right? So, but if you want agent to put effort in both dimensions, you should reward this effort to the same extent. Reward this effort to the same extent. Now, some of you with a mathematical mind could challenge this idea in one technical aspect, namely that, well, look, the costs of effort are specified as
a function of the total of the time and effort spent on doing the activities. So the total cost of effort is not C of E1 plus C of E2. The total cost of effort is a C of E1 plus E2. That's an important, it may sound innocent, but it's an important, it makes an important difference. Because if you can specify costs of effort separately, then doing the same maths would bring you to different conclusions. And it's an open question, I would say, whether the costs of effort are separately in effort dimensions or joint. If they were separate in different effort dimensions, then it doesn't matter. So if you could write down C of E1 plus C of E2, then it means that the effort you spent on one dimension has no effect on the marginal cost of effort in another dimension. It's something like, yesterday I had to do research and prepare materials for today's personnel economics lecture. I had my E1 and E2. It took me until 9 o'clock in the evening to prepare the materials for today's personnel economics lecture. I was totally knackered, I was exhausted, and then I had to do research. Now, according to the view that the costs of effort are separate, I should be as fresh as Daisy at 9 o'clock in the evening to do my research, but guess what? I was next to useless in terms of my research. Why? Because I was pretty tired of this one. So my personal experience suggests that this is the right formulation, and if that's the case, then we're back to the equal compensation principle. Now, I cannot overstate the importance of equal compensation principle. I want you to also think one additional moment about it. This is a very severe restriction implied by the first order condition. It's a very severe restriction because what it basically says is you have to reward performance based on the worst measured performance indicator. Not the best measured performance indicator, the worst measured performance indicator, right? So if you have sales and customer service is measured not very precisely, you should reward sales weakly. You should reward sales a lot, you know, less strongly than your optimality would require. And one corollary from this unfortunate fact is that, well, if you think about it, 25% of firms or thereabouts, between 25 and 30% of firms practice incentives. If the incentives are so cool, why don't you have 100% of firms practicing incentives? Well, because in a variety of situations, you have this equal compensation problem, right? You have this hidden, poorly measured effort, which limits the choice of optimal incentive schemes by firms. And for what many firms do is they just throw their hands up in the air and say, oh, I've had it. No incentives anymore. Because if I practice weak incentives, it's not going to be very good. It's not going to encourage the agent's effort very much. And even if I practice weak incentives, where is the guarantee that there is no third dimension of effort, E3, which is not part of this picture yet, and which is very, very hard to measure. And if I do that, I will have agents concentrating on E1 and E2, not working hard on either of them because of this, and totally neglecting E3, which is, of course, one of the worst situations you can be. So why not all firms practice incentives? We have seen various reasons. We had a lecture on firm size and uncertainty and the tenuous trade-off between risk and incentives. Here's another reason. Equal compensation principle limits the choice of optimal incentive scheme, and because of this limitation, not all firms choose to have incentives at all. Now, lastly, the alignment principle. The alignment principle. So we are still in the world of multidimensional effort. But now we are in the world of multidimensional proxies for the value of agent's activity to the principal. What is the value of agent's activity to the principal? It's the long-term value of the firm that the agent creates for the principal thanks to their efforts, right? So, but this long-term value is observed, yes, in the long term, and I need to reward the principal now. So I use proxies, and I use different proxies. If you look at the accounting reports, and if you look at the multiple page documents outlining the details of incentive pay schemes for middle managers and multi-hundred page documents outlining the details of incentive schemes for executives, you'll see that there are really lots and lots of different dimensions of performance on which the agents are rewarded. So the alignment principle dictates that the extent to which agents' effort affects the proxies for performance should be as close as possible to the extent to which the agent's effort affects performance itself. I'll show you the maths and you will see what I mean. So here is, we are in the world of two-dimensional effort. No specific reason why it's two-dimensional other than the simplicity of maths. We are in the world of two-dimensional effort. Here is the value to the principal. This is the outcome desired by the principal. It depends on sales, it depends on customer service, with weights delta 1 and delta 2. So remember this, delta 1 and delta 2. Every euro of sales generates 30 cents of long-term value to the firm. Every unit of customer service generates 300 euros for the long-term value of the firm. Okay. Now, but why is not observed? Is not observed during the period of time that you need to reward your principal for his effort. It's a long-term outcome, right? What you do observe instead is a performance measure P. Let's say accounting profit at the end of the year. And the accounting profit at the end of the year is, of course, influenced by the sales generating activities. So here is gamma 1, the weight, the coefficient through which sales generating activities affect accounting profit at the end of the year. And it's also affected by the customer service. And the customer service comes with coefficient gamma 2. And there are noise terms here. Okay. So the performance pay contract of the agent is linear in performance measure P, which is in itself, which is in turn a linear combination of the, which is in turn a linear combination of these two guys. So the question is, why is it P? Why is it not separately by E1 and E2? Good question. Go back to the equal compensation principle to work it out. It's sort of mildly useful exercise because it's not going to generate a lot of new insights. So that's why I simplify things by, you know, using just P. Now, the costs of effort are specified like this. Now, notice the cheeky moment here. I'm really into simplifications. Notice that here the costs of effort are separate. So opposite to what I said just minutes ago, the costs of effort are separate. It doesn't matter how much effort I invested in teaching for my productivity in research. But if you want to have it non-separate, forget it. The math is going to be very complicated. So to simplify maths and to get to the main idea, we make these simplifications. We make these simplifying assumptions. So here is the certainty equivalent of the payoff to the agent, fixed wage, strength of incentives times performance measure, minus costs of effort, minus the risk premium. Okay. So during the tutorial today, if time allows, we will derive the optimal beta in this case. And the optimal beta looks like this. This is an optimal beta. Now, substituting it into the expected profit formula, you get the expected profit. So what is interesting here is to compare the profit that you realize as a result of this incentive scheme with the profit that you could have realized if you lived in the world of first best. Remember first best, Pareto optimal? The most of it, so you maximize welfare. Maximizing welfare gives you the expected profit equal to this expression. So this is the actual profit here. This is the expected profit. They are different. The expected, the first best profit is greater than actual profit. Take the difference between them. And then after some simplification, you get the following result. And it's a beautiful result because what it says, it identifies the two sources. It identifies the two sources of inefficiency in the design of incentive schemes. So we're learning something. One source of inefficiency we already know is risk premium, right? So far what we know is, why are we not doing as efficiently as we could have done? Oh, because this horrible agent is not risk neutral, is risk averse, and therefore requires some risk premium in the form of higher wage than his participation constraint would otherwise have had. So there's nothing new here. The new bit here is this, is the misalignment. This term reduces the actual profit compared to what it could have been in the ideal world. And it has nothing to do with risk preferences. On top of risk preferences, there's this additional effect of misalignment. Now, here's a question. Under what circumstances would this misalignment be zero? Under what circumstances would we go back to the nice and well-studied case of the only source of inefficiency being non-neutral risk preferences of the agent? Well, if you have a proportionality between gammas and deltas, then delta 1 times gamma 2 minus gamma 1 times delta 2, this is really the expression for misalignment here. If gammas and deltas were proportional, then this guy would be zero. This is the mathematical essence, if you like, of the alignment principle. What does alignment mean? Alignment means this. This is gamma. Gamma measures the extent to which sales generating effort increase accounting profit at the end of the year. This is delta 1. It measures the extent to which sales generating effort affects long-term value of the firm. Gamma 2 measures the extent to which customer service increases the profit at the end of the year. Delta 2 measures the extent to which customer service increases the long-term value of the firm. If there's a proportionality between them, it means that the extent to which efforts increase outcomes in the short run are proportional or aligned with the extent to which the efforts along the same dimensions increase the long-term value of the firm. Here's the essence of the alignment principle, right? Now, what happens in reality, of course, is that this ratio is approximately 1, slightly less than 1, okay? And this ratio is very large because the extent to which customer service affects your profits today is minimal, is next to zero, right? What you want to do is you want to sell as much as possible. You don't want to spend time with these, you know, customers complaining about things. You'd rather not take their phone calls. You'd rather start selling more, right? But in the long term, in the long run, this is going to backfire. So gamma 2 is close to zero. Delta 2 is not zero, right? So this ratio is going to be very large. This ratio is going to be about 1. Misalignment. What does it mean? So delta 1 times gamma 2 is about 0. Gamma 1 times delta 2 is very large. So delta 1 gamma 2 minus gamma 1 delta 2 is here. Okay, so this difference, when the misalignment is severe, in my example, this difference is going to be very large. Square it to make things worse, and you will have a huge problem. You'll have a huge gap between the profit that you actually observe from the agent's actions and the profit that you could have observed if only you could devise incentives in more aligned way. Right. So hello to my property agent, who was very keen to contact me and inquire when I will pay the money for my flat, and who is not very keen to answer to my questions about the gas boiler and other aspects once I bought the flat. Here's your, you know, alignment, an example. And of course, when somebody asks me about my evaluations, I will post my sincere opinion about the quality of the post-sale services. I don't know to what extent it's going to affect the long-term value of that firm, but that's a sort of a real-life example, if you like. So, what makes a good performance measure? So, one thing that we've learned so far is that the ratio of the is that these ratios of deltas to gammas should be as close to each other as possible, right? So that's what alignment means. Well, but then you should say, well, how can you ensure alignment? One naive thing that you could do, that your compensation and benefits consultant could advise you for 500 euros an hour, is to say, well, look, you don't know what is correlated with what. Let us do statistical analysis, and we have the data about long-term return on investment and short-term accounting indicators. Let us correlate one with the other and find correlations between long-term value of the firm and different short-run outcomes. And based on these correlations, we will devise the incentive schemes so as to minimize the misalignment to the highest extent possible. So that looks scientific enough, but and it is sort of scientific in a naive way. The problem with this argument is that if you have a high correlation between something that you measure in the short run, the short run performance measure, and something that is occurred in the long run, simply high correlation between these guys is not sufficient. Right? So if you find some short-term performance measure which is very well correlated with long-term outcome, don't rejoice prematurely, because it's not sufficient. And why it's not sufficient is because this high correlation between short-term and long-run outcome may in fact be due to the common noise term. Right? Here is a mathematical example which tells you exactly what's going on. So suppose there is a long-term, the long-term outcome is only affected by customer service, and the short-term outcome is only affected by sales. But there are other factors such as macroeconomy, such as brand, such as size of the firm, such as too big to fail considerations, what have you. As long as this common component in the short and long run indicators is strong enough, this will generate the high correlation between P and Y. But actually, if you look at P, P is clearly useless for Y. Why is it useless for Y? Because Y does not depend on E2, whereas P does depend on E2. Yeah? So simply a high correlation between these two guys is not sufficient, right? Can you improve on this situation? Yes, you could do. You could go back to this example 2 of the informativeness principle, and in the example 2 shows you how you can make use of the seemingly irrelevant performance measures whose noise is correlated with the noise of your relevant performance measure. So the situation that I have just explained with Y being influenced by E1 and P being influenced by E2 is not a hopeless situation. You can generate an incentive scheme which is based on relative performance evaluation principle that we have discussed some minutes ago. But in terms of alignment, this of course is totally useless, right? So this piece of text summarizes my thought. Benchmarking helps to control for the effects of common shocks on P and Y. Recall the informativeness principle. Okay, so let us look at some practical applications of performance evaluation principles, and it will smoothly transition us to the second part of the performance evaluation lecture, much of which I guess we will study next week. But let's begin. Okay, so we've looked into the science of performance evaluation, some scientific principles of performance evaluation, and the next chapter in lectures like this is traditionally to say, oh, there is a gap between the science of doing X and the practice of doing X. I would argue that the gap between the science of doing X and the practice of doing performance evaluation is not that wide. I would argue that for one reason or the other, there's actually quite a close relationship between how the practice of how performance evaluations are administered in practice and how they should be devised based on the scientific principles of performance evaluation. So one thing I have to say is very often we see multiple performance evaluation agents and multiple performance evaluation instances. So basically, here is an example. Here is an example. So you have multiple evaluators. You have the self-evaluations and the evaluations along the same dimensions of the managers. So these are two performance measures, right? And the informativeness principle, I think, is here, you know, abundantly illustrated. You also see that you have more than one criterion for evaluation. Again, the informativeness principle is vindicated here. When you use more than one criterion for evaluation, in this way you capture multidimensional and rich information about which is informative in the statistical sense about the desired performance outcome. Look here. This is an evaluation from Burger King, I think, right? I just copied it. Yeah. So Burger King, this is bullshit, right? All these keys to the kingdom, but you know, the funny terms notwithstanding, right? Let's look into the heart of the matter, because these guys are not very academic, right? They are more sort of mission oriented, team building, and which could be strategically optimal. But let's look into the essence, and the essence is that there are multiple criteria, and you know, the list is longer than this. There are multiple criteria against which performance is evaluated by this time two evaluators. The number of evaluators may actually be more than two. I am evaluated by hundreds of evaluators when I have student evaluations. When I was applying for a job here, I was evaluated by a committee, right? So you would have Nick's evaluation form having more than two evaluators. So the scientific principle of informativeness is very much used in the real world in the administration of performance evaluation. This is not to say that we get excellent measures of performance this way, but this is to say that reasonable effort is taken even by the likes of Burger King to capture the essence in to do performance evaluation in the reasonable way. So you also see, I already mentioned this, you also see that firms evaluate absolute as well as relative performance. Absolute as well as relative performance. You get certain bonus for meeting your personal targets, and you also get a certain bonus for going above your benchmark performance results. Let me Right. No, I don't have an example of. I used to have it in some of my slides. Just bear with me a second. I used to have an example of a firm that rewards rewards individual performance outcomes as well as team performance outcome, and that's and it does it in a relative way. But for some reason, I've removed it, or it's in the previous version of the slides. Never mind. Let's move on. So here's my evaluation results from Goethe University Frankfurt. That's how it looks like. So just to summarize, and let's stop here because clearly we won't have time to go through the rest and we'll have to do it next week. Clearly what I wanted to say is that the examples are abundant and they point out to the direction that firms actually use informativeness principle and firms use firms use both example one and example two of the informativeness principle. Example one by having multiple criteria for performance evaluation. Example two is when they use a relative absolute as well as relative performance evaluations. Now, the fact that performance evaluation is more serious and more expensive process for more senior employees, 360 degree feedback is one of the most expensive ways you can carry out performance evaluation. This points out to the monitoring intensity principle. The fact that many firms don't practice incentives points out to the problems with alignment and equal compensation. I wish I had two lectures in a row, then I could make a story more interesting than these just bullet points. But there we are. Let's take a break now and meet next week to further study practical aspects of performance evaluation. Yes, we do have tutorial today, that's right. So I'm talking about lectures, and today we'll have tutorial as well. At 3:15, right? See you there. Thank you.